Welcome on to a Wednesday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball NBA podcast. Going to preview for trade purposes the Southeast Division now. Let's get started with the Charlotte Hornets. Danny has put these in order of the teams he thinks are most interesting, and he picked the Hornets first. Why is that?
Kemba Walker. I mean, it's the most compelling decision in this division. They aren't necessarily going to do the most because of that, but Kemba's such a sea change for them. If they decide to move him or not, he is the best player on this team, and if they choose to move him, it's probably going to be for young guys, so then we're probably not talking a whole lot about the Hornets for the next couple of years. Like, I think that's going to be the choice that they have to make to get their fundamentals. They're about $2.9 million below the luxury tax right now. They have one free roster spot, and they're right around the tax line for next season, with Travion Graham being a restricted free agent, who we both like. And if their pick is, you know, if it ends up being a stronger pick, then that starts to make it more expensive too, and then the tax calculations get more complicated.
Yeah, and I think a lot of why it might make sense to move on from Walker is improving their own pick this year. They could get right into the mix. There's quite the morass of teams, you know, who are just below them right now in terms of projected record. Hornets projected at 38-44. I guess they would have to drop back pretty significantly into like the very low 30s range, but given the way that they've played without Walker so far this season, that might be quite doable for them. They only listed as 33% playoff odds right now by our friends at 538. So, I mean, let's just start with this Walker thing. Mark Stein, surprised me when he was on our show a couple days ago by saying that he thinks they will at least listen on Kemba. My thought is Michael Jordan has not really shown that sort of proactivity, especially when it makes the team worse, but certainly they should be listening to him. I think they should try to trade him. But obviously, if the right offer is not there, then it doesn't make a ton of sense. So, just as a general proposition, before we think about like what some potential suitors for him could be, like, what do you think is a fair return for him?
I would say you're looking for either a premium asset, which I think is unlikely, so that would be like maybe like a top seven to ten pick, or something a little bit lower than that with something else. So that's like the discussion. I think Bontemps has brought this up before, of like Frank Ntilikina and another like late lottery pick or something in that range, or
I think
salary.
I was the first one to bring that up.
You might be
on this show.
We
spent like 15 minutes on it, actually. Not that Tim like stole my idea by any means, but I thought we were the first ones who started.
We might have been. It all becomes a blur for me. And so
it was us, damn it.
But so I think that's kind of the range you're looking at. And one of the challenges with trading Kemba Walker is there aren't that many teams that A, have a need for him, and B, have that kind of asset available. And part of the reason why the Knicks make so much sense is that they have that, and then also the salary component of it that they can work with.
Yeah, and again, we talked about this with time, but to reiterate why they would want to move on from him, number one, I mean, this is an expensive, older team already, and not one that looks like it's going to make the playoffs this season. We all picked them for the playoffs, but a lot of these teams that were below them looking a lot better has been a big part of why they've been out, and obviously they've had some bad luck, but also just have not played that well.
I want to bring up one other big point, which is the idea of his next contract. So Kemba's on a wonderful deal, $12 million a year these next 2 years. This is age 27 season. Next year is age 28. He will turn 29 before free agency, but that's, you know, that'll be his age 29 season. With where Charlotte is right now, it doesn't look like I would be, unless his market is just way lower than we think it's going to be, and Isaiah is some sort of semblance of an idea here.
It could be lower, for sure, but it is lower, it's because he wasn't playing that well, and the team wasn't that good over the next year and a half that his contract continues for.
Right, so I don't think I would want to, where Charlotte is, I don't think I would want to give Kemba his next contract. Other teams, you know, there's certain teams that would trade for him that absolutely could, because he's on the smaller side, but not small. He's 6'1 or thereabouts, so it's not the whole like sub-6-foot worries that you have. And I think Kemba's game will age reasonably well, but if he loses a step or a half a step, it will get a little bit worse. So to me, you want to be in a team where he's elevating you right now, and that maybe you have some other young players that can grow with him. And that's not where the Hornets are. They have a lot of money tied up for a couple of years and guys that are probably not going to get meaningfully better, and probably in certain cases are going to get worse. And so there just isn't as much incentive if he's not helping you that much right now, and you probably don't want to sign his next contract, well, then you should probably move him.
Yeah, that all makes sense. But there is a point, especially in Charlotte, a team that, we can't rebuild in this market. You know, they're one of those teams. And certainly, even if they were to move Walker, there's much more work to do in terms of clearing the books to kind of get some more flexibility and use your salary cap cap space as an asset to either take on bad contracts or maybe even sign young players at this point too. I mean, now those any team with space is going to start to be more desirable because there just are not as many, at least this offseason. But there's really no way, even if they move Walker, that they can get there. I mean, presumably any kind of a Walker trade would require taking back some bad money as well, so they'd have to get some value there. But yeah, I mean, I think something along the lines of two first round picks, a prospect or a first round pick, you know. And so I think Ntilikina and maybe a lottery protected first from the Knicks would be like kind of what I was looking for if I were them. Maybe that would also include taking back some undesirable money from New York as well. But that's not an amazing deal for Charlotte, but it just gets them going in the right direction and of course improves their draft pick this year. Other teams that in theory could use Walker, I guess you could say the Jazz, although Donovan Mitchell and he are somewhat redundant, and maybe they could send Ricky Rubio back and then end up buying out Rubio. The Spurs, again, they don't operate this way, and they don't really have the type of premium draft picks, but if I were the Spurs, I would at least say, hey, how interested are you in DeJounte Murray and Kyle Anderson and Derek White and, you know, a first round pick or two in the future, because they certainly could use what he needs, especially with the Kawhi Leonard news that came in today, which we'll talk about a little bit later. The Knicks, we mentioned them, of course. I mean, the Magic don't really seem, or the Hawks don't really seem like teams that would be trying to go there. Phoenix is an interesting one if they want to try and get better, but it doesn't make any sense for them to get better this year. They're already out of playoff contention, and so they don't want to better their draft pick this year. So yeah, I mean, if you had to pick a most likely suitor out of all of those teams, who do you think it is?
I think the Knicks are most likely, and then I'm going to add in one more team, and that's the Indiana Pacers. The Pacers, yes, could really use him, and they have a lot of filler salary, including money that they could, you know, non-guarantees or light guarantees, that sort of thing. So I think that would be a wonderful fit, and they've had a great year, and they're trying to figure out what to do next to Victor Oladipo, but I think Kemba would be massive for them.
I'll throw in one more team too, which is the Detroit Pistons. You know, maybe they put Reggie Jackson into that trade. Stanley Johnson, although I don't know what his value is, probably not incredibly high. Certainly they, I think, would be willing to
move Kennard.
Kennard is someone that they like. But yeah, and then maybe another a first rounder as well. You know, maybe that could be the construct there. It'd be interesting for Charlotte to have both Malik Monk and Kennard, 11 and 12, both shooting guards from this draft. But you never know with those guys, which of them is going to work out more.
Not only that, but both shooting guards from North Carolina schools.
Yeah. No.
Oh, no. Malik Monk went to Kentucky. I thought he went to North Carolina.
He put up 47 against
Kentucky.
Carolina.
Yeah, that could be what it was.
Yeah. I mean, I think we both agree Kemba is their most likely player to be traded. We've been doing that category. But if you had to just eyeball it from here, what do you think the percent chance is that he gets traded?
I was going to say 10%, but if Mark Stein's going to say that they're considering it, I'll move it up to 15.
Yeah, I still think it's pretty low, both in terms of calibrating the value. Teams are still very judicious these days about sending out first rounders. And although Detroit tried to do it for Donis Mataunas and was saved by the fact that his physical did not come up the way they wanted it to. I mean, I think in the 15-20% range, but I mean, the fact that he at least thinks they'll listen, I don't know whether that's really going to be true or not. I mean, I have a lot of skepticism again about the Charlotte organization's ability to do anything that proactive. Let's talk about some of their other things that we can here, though. Any of these other vets have some trade value? Certainly, if they were to move on from Walker, they would explore Batum, Marvin Williams. I think Kid Gilchrist actually is someone that they might look to move. Cody Zeller is someone who might have a little bit of value on his contract, although he's coming off that meniscus injury and hasn't been able to stay healthy. I don't know. There's a lot of guys who are kind of like, I guess maybe someone is interested in eye of the beholder type of guys, but they're not really, you know, great values on their contracts.
The other challenge there, which is a big one, is the amount of years that they have means that I think the kind of offers you're going to get for somebody like MKG is him for somebody with a way worse contract, maybe similar terms, but just a bad player and then some sort of asset. And then your asset valuation is very difficult because you're sitting there going, well, okay, what's this drop off? What does this drop off mean? And for MKG, maybe that's doable, but like Marvin Williams, I think that could be hard. So those guys are both making like 13, 14 million a year for two more for this year, next year, and then have player options for 1920.
Yeah. And Batum is something that we've been critical of for years now, is the fact that they made his contract increase rather than decline when they had full board rights and it didn't affect their 2016 cap space. They'd be in a little bit more luxury tax concerns right now had they had it decline. But nonetheless, he's 22, 22 this year, goes all the way up to 27 for his player option that I think he might exercise. That's always that'll be a really, really fun like rankings of like player options most likely to be exercised.
I had one other one I wanted to throw at you. How are you feeling about Jeremy Lamb's $7.5 million for next year?
I mean, I still think that's probably a little bit of a negative asset.
I think it's a slight negative. I was working on a little thing today about the Cavs, and the idea basically being that they could theoretically use Channing Frye's expiring contract to trade for somebody who could contribute more. And I had this fleeting thought of, Frye for Lamb would actually be interesting, because the idea being that if LeBron leaves, they're over the cap and under the tax, so it doesn't really make that big a difference. So I had this little fleeting idea. I think Cleveland would need something else back, just because that's a lot of money for next year and the value difference isn't that big. But the framework of it was more intriguing than I thought when I first started floating it.
Yeah, I don't think he helps the Cavs really. I would be skeptical of that one. He's just like a crappier J.R. Smith, basically. All right, anything else you wanted to say on these guys here? I guess there's a slight possibility that they would like try to get better. They're in this midst of this stretch now with 8 of 9 at home, so maybe they heat up and they say, hey, we're going to try and improve our bench a little bit.
They can. The problem is that they just don't have much movable salary. Almost everybody's on a multi-year deal, so like even if they like wanted to trade, let's say, Frank Kaminsky or somebody like that, they can't really do much with that. And they could be a buyout candidate, just because, you know, if you're a buyout guy who wants to play, you're going to get an option on their bench. But I just don't see much in the way of trading with that, and it would be foolhardy for them to give up their first, and then they have Cleveland's 2018 second, but they don't have their own.
Yeah, it does seem like more of a buyout destination. But I mean, what we could also see is maybe some kind of a move to try to clear out some more room under the tax. As you mentioned, they have that open roster spot. They're $1.9 million below the tax. I mean, we're probably getting to the point now where veteran contracts are more expensive than they used to be, or they could sign someone for the rest of the season and be okay there on the buyout market. I mean, I do think that Derrick Rose, if Cleveland wanted to buy him out, could be a decent fit there for their second unit point guard, assuming, of course, that he could stay healthy. But there's not a ton out there in terms of backup point guard help. And Carter Williams, I mean, he's been just so miserable this year. I think I saw somewhere he might be shooting 30.1% from the field this season. Field goal percentage of 33.7%. I don't know why their second unit has struggled so much. I can't put my finger on it. Just for fun, I'm going to look up what he's shooting on layups. 49% on layups and 14% from 3 to 10 feet.
Hey, who knows? Maybe he can be the next Tyreek Evans. Rookie of the year disappoints and can do it somewhere else. Probably not.
Oh, that is really... I knew it was bad. I didn't realize it was quite that terrible. All right, let's move on to Atlanta here.
Speaking of quite that terrible, the Atlanta Hawks. The Hawks they're just over the cap right now. And if they wanted to spend, of course, it's only on a free agent, but they could use their room exception. That would be maybe more of like pay a guy a little bit more money now and get some sort of non-guarantee for the second year. I think that wouldn't be a terrible idea, depending on how this works out.
Similar fashion to what the Pacers did with Lance Stephenson last year.
Right. Yeah, that could be an option for them. They have no open roster spots right now, but they could clear one. They're the Hawks. And they're also hoping to clear them through some of their moves. I have it that they have about $22 million in space this summer if Dedmon and Muscala opt in. Those guys, Dedmon's player option is $6.3 million. Muscala's is $5 million. I don't really have a strong opinion yet on which way that's going to go. So, I mean, their primary objective is to sell. I mean, that's pretty obvious. And what I think is the most interesting question is going to be, how intently do they shop and or listen for guys like Bazemore and Schroeder? Because, they're going to get the best offer possible for Bellinelli and Ilyasova, but how are they feeling about their guard rotation?
Yeah, I think Schroeder is an interesting one. Bazemore is someone that Brian Windhorst, I think it might have been someone else who was on that podcast last week, suggested that maybe the Cavs could use. I don't think Bazemore really helps the Cavs that much. The problem with him has always been he hasn't quite had the size to really defend guys on the wing, really true small forward types who can score. But Bazemore still probably a negative asset on that contract, but again, one of those 2016 guys where he could easily be exchanged for someone with an even worse contract who's making about the same. Bazemore salary goes up 17 this year, 18 next year, and 19 the year after that, which is a player option, which I think he might exercise that player option, but he can still play, which separates him from a lot of the guys who got similar contracts at this point. Schroeder, you think anybody would want him? I was trying to go through and I couldn't really find a great fit. You know, there are some point guard needy teams, but I think in contrast to Walker, Schroeder has not really established himself as a good enough shooter to play off the ball the way Walker can, and just, you know, nowhere near as good a player as Walker is either.
Also, a way less desirable contract because it's $15.5 million flat every year through 2020-21. So if you were sure he was the answer, that's not a bad contract, but I don't think anybody's sure of that right now. So I had thought about the idea of, oh, what if Orlando is risk averse with Elfrid Payton? But I don't think Elfrid Payton is going to sign a richer contract than Dennis Schroeder got. And that, you know, so, and I would rather roll the dice on restricted free agency at this point than do something like Schroeder.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, Schroeder could make sense for a team like Phoenix. I loathe his fit with Devin Booker, but he would be an upgrade on what they've had at point guard recently. And again, I mean, I think the construct for Schroeder, I mean, it's not like Schroeder is so good that he's keeping Atlanta out of the basement where they want to be in terms of their draft pick. Although they've been kind of unlucky this year, I think. And then for him, it's just, yeah, I guess he could, like, you know, it'd be a chance for another team to improve. But then, I mean, the Hawks are really consigning themselves to be awful. He's like the only thing that's even remotely watchable. He and John Collins are at this point. So I would say the chance of him getting moved are pretty low. I mean, again, it could be, he could be sort of a vehicle for getting bad salary back onto the team. And maybe that enhances the draft pick compensation that they could get. But I mean, if you were Atlanta and you just got like a mid offer of a middling first round pick for him, would you take it? I mean, assuming you didn't have to take back bad money.
Absolutely. I think of Schroeder as a slight negative, maybe even a little more than a slight negative on his contract. So if somebody's going to offer that, darn tootin'.
Yeah, I mean, he's young enough that he could still theoretically get there. He has a lot of physical tools. He's taken some steps forward this year. So I guess I probably would do it as well. But again, it's probably not realistic to just take back no salary for the long term for him. You're probably getting some bad money back as well. And then maybe, you know, you would want more than that first rounder. Let's get, though, to the guys who are obviously going to be on the block here for Atlanta.
So pretty much everybody else but the rookie scale guys. So that's, I mean, Ilyasova and Bellinelli are the two clear ones. I believe it was Mike Scotto that had that they're looking for high second round picks for both those guys. One weird problem for this year is that there aren't many high second round picks in the hands of teams that are being competitive. You know, usually that's through an old standing trade. One that is Brooklyn's pick is owned by Philly. So they could go in that direction if, let's say they felt that Bellinelli was an upgrade over what they have.
You know, with Redick being out for a little while now, I mean, Bellinelli could maybe help them. But, you know, I've always thought that Bellinelli was vastly overrated. And, you know, I think you could probably do better with a high second round pick than Marco Bellinelli. But maybe other people will see it differently. Or, I mean, the other thing they could consider, too, is, you know, they've got Ilyasova. Ilyasova and Muscala both have implicit no trades. Although, actually, I'm not sure why Mike Muscala necessarily would. So I think he's got a player option for next year, but as opposed to a team option. But maybe he does. I forget whether a player option works that way. I know a team option does. But anyway, yeah, so you've got Ilyasova making $6 million. Bellinelli makes 6.6. You know, maybe what the Hawks could hope to do is something I thought they actually should have done last year with a lot of their guys who were on expiring contracts, is just try to aggregate these guys together, take back some bad salary, and then maybe get a first rounder out of that. With, you know, if you got two guys that you think could help a team, and, you know, I think Ilyasova and Bellinelli together maybe could help a team fortify the bench. And, you know, Philly is one of those teams that comes to mind. But again, I don't know if Philly is not going to be too interested in giving up picks. Maybe Andrzej Pasternak, if they are interested in him.
Well, the way that you could get an asset from Philly is if they can include Bayless in that trade.
Right. Yeah. That would make a lot of sense. We'll talk, because they want to get rid of Bayless for their own cap hopes this offseason. Dwayne Dedmon, also someone who I think it could help certain teams. $6 million this year, $6.3 million player option for next year. Muscala, similar boat. He's barely played this year because that pretty severe ankle injury. $5 million this year, $5 million player option for next year. All those guys you think would be on the block. Luke Babbitt, another guy maybe who could just help a team a little bit that needs some shooting off the bench from the four position.
Yeah, one that I've been toying with, partially because they're one of my teams for the trade deadline, I don't think that spoils anything, is the idea of a Denver Atlanta Banda trade, something we actually did in the mock deadline last year, but that was a Paul Millsap trade that ended up happening, not the deadline, because Denver just has so much money for next year that they're looking to unload, and they're actually kind of competent players. I could see Travis Schlenk just being like, hey, you know, these guys can actually play, maybe we can even move them during next season or something like that. But I think it's just a little too early for Atlanta to give up their space.
Yeah, do you think Dedmon will opt in? I think he probably will. Center market sucks,
but would he be willing to give up like a million or two just to be able to choose his own destination? I think you could get somewhere in the four range during the year. So for me, the option of doing that and being on a more competitive team would be worth it. But again, I haven't ever had to choose to give away $2 million. So
yeah. And for someone like Babbitt, you know, you could see maybe him getting traded for just sort of a fringe 13th or 14th man with some modicum of potential on another team who's not really playing right now. You know, I don't know that he is even good enough to warrant like a second rounder, unless it's like a very late second rounder for a contender. And there's always teams that can use some more shooting off the bench. So, all of those are in play. I mean, it's just a question of what is the price? You know, do they, and I think, you know, the idea of aggregating all these guys together, taking back some, not some awful salary, but, you know, someone like Bayless, I think is an interesting one, where it's just, you know, $9 million in dead money for next year, which is probably not enough to merit a first rounder on its own. But then when you throw in that there's part of this year left and you can get the services of these vets that they have, then maybe you can squeeze a first rounder for, you know, not necessarily Bayless, but that sort of a contract that ends a year from now. I think that's the type of deal I would be looking for with them.
One other quick thing to mention, the Hawks are flush in terms of draft assets. They have all their own picks, plus they have 2018 first round picks from Minnesota and Houston. It looks like they're just going to get those straight out. And then they have that 2019 first from the Cavs, which is protected. So they have a lot of those assets moving forward. They already have Collins, Bembry, and Torian Prince all on rookie scale contracts, plus their own draft pick too.
Yeah, I mean, you could see them with all these picks that they have that are relatively middling, and you could see them either trying to move up in certain drafts, or they could end up being kind of where Phoenix and Sacramento have been these last few years, of just so many young guys, rookie scale guys. But I don't think that's the end of the world. I think because rookies are really kind of crapshoots, that you get enough of those guys and just hope to hit on some of them. You know, I think it's not the end of the world to have that. So and Travis Schlenk clearly has a mandate and a philosophy of a complete and total rebuild right now. All right, most likely to be traded for these guys.
Marco Bellinelli.
Yeah, it seems like it, just because Ilyasova can veto a trade, and then Dedmon has a player option for next year, Muscala has a player option next year, so and teams always want shooting. So with all that, I think Marco, most likely, for sure, it would be a failure to not trade him.
Well, let's move on to a team that you disagreed with my ordering and go to the Orlando Magic, just to have them a little bit higher. The Magic are just under the salary cap, and if they wanted to use their full room exception in the way we just talked about with the Hawks to sign somebody and give a multi-year thing, they could do that. They have no open roster spots, and they're probably right around the tax for next year, but that depends so much on what Aaron Gordon and Elfrid Payton get as restricted free agents, that those are complicated negotiations for myriad reasons. And so that puts Orlando in a sticky spot, because they don't really have a ton of ways to change, but they have big decisions to make all the same.
I don't know if they're right around the tax. Well, yeah, I guess if Aaron Gordon gets, you know, close to the max, and Payton gets, you know, 12-13 million, then yeah, you're probably pretty close to the tax, which certainly is not going to be very palatable for them. We'll assume that Shelvin Mack's $6 million non-guarantee for next year, they move on from that. But yeah, they are very unlikely to have cap space this offseason, which is certainly frustrating given how awful they've been this year. So what do you think they're trying to do
here? It would be great if they could just clean up their books a little bit. They have just so much money, like guys like Vooch and Ross, that aren't bad players, but just fill it up so they don't really have much flexibility. I don't think they have the ability to move Fournier or Biombo, just because those guys are both making $17 million for another couple of years, and that's a lot of money for a long time. And, you know, if they can, they don't really have the Bellinellis and Ilyasovas of the world, so veterans that have interest, that generate interest at their salaries, but they could theoretically, if they wanted to be a little bit bolder, they could take on some money either through Shelvin Mack, because as you the aforementioned non-guarantee, or Mario Hezonja. I mean, Hezonja has a good opportunity to play there because they're tanking, basically. But they could do that. And then they don't have the flexibility in terms of taking on money outside of Shelvin Mack, but that's a good way to do it.
Yeah, he is an expiring contract that could be useful. And I mean, with them kind of being capped out, you know, I disagree with you on Fournier. I think that he, you know, probably not worth the $17 million flat that he's due over the next 3 years after this one. Also another player option, by the way. He's young enough that it's actually conceivable he could opt out of that. Biombo will not be opting out of his $17 million that ends a year earlier. But Fournier, again, fits into that construct of guys who are somewhat overpaid, but not nearly as overpaid as some other guys and actually can play. I think Mark and I were talking about this the other day, that he at least is someone who can help a team, although, you know, having him as your second option, as the Magic have found, is pretty inadequate offensively. And he's not a great defensive player either, but knows how to play. So I think it would make a lot of sense to move him. Vucevic, I'm sure they would love to move. But again, it, you know, when you mentioned cleaning up their books, I mean, I think actually it makes more sense to further dirty their books, if anything, and try to pick up some draft compensation, because, you know, Ross, Vucevic, again, those are guys who maybe they could try to package to pick up guys with worse salary. Because otherwise, I mean, if you're going to try to get rid of those guys and just open up space, you're giving up draft pick compensation, which then you would just be trying to get back by taking back more bad contracts with that very same space. Or, you know, you would just be trying to sign people in free agency, which, you know, given where the team is right now, it doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense to me. And they'd have to get rid of so much to really be players in free agency anyway this year, and then there are going to be a lot more teams with space next year. Hard to imagine them as a desirable free agent destination. We certainly have seen them have to overpay and strike out quite a bit here. So I think I probably would just hold on to guys like that, and then maybe next year when they're expiring contracts and they can still play, you know, they have even more value. But it's, I think it's either they hold on to them or they take back worse contracts.
Orlando, what helps your argument is that they just don't have a clear-cut time to say, hey, this is when we're going to have cap space and we're going to have some interesting young players. I mean, if we assume Aaron Gordon and probably Elfrid Payton are back on this team next year on multi-year contracts, you have those guys and then Biombo for sure in 2019-20. And so between that, and they could probably get out of Augustine if they wanted to, they're probably not going to have money in 2019, especially with adding in a couple other what it look like they're going to be high-end draft picks. And so that adds like $15 million to your books or something in that range with all their other stuff. So if you run on that logic, if they could move their 2018-19 expiring guys, Vooch, Ross, things of that nature, for guys that have one more year, they could probably get some real assets there. I mean, you talk about, then that gets you in like the Brandon Knight Derby, some of the Bucks guys, those sorts of things. Not saying they should make that move right now, probably, because teams aren't as desperate yet. They haven't figured out how bad that's going to be. But next year, maybe over the offseason, those options will be available.
Yeah, and even as late as next year, I mean, there are going to be a lot of teams in the tax, a lot of teams trying to shed money, even although I don't know that they'll just have pure cap space to not send anything back for tax purposes next year. But so much depends on what happens with Gordon and Payton. I mean, as of right now, I project them with $43 million in the summer of 2019, could get up to even more than that if they were to move on from John Simmons. But again, you know, if Payton or Gordon were to return, I mean, they could also just try to play the game of, you know, we'll sign guys to one-year deals and then move them in similar fashion to what the Hawks have done. But, you know, how much space are they really going to have for that? Not really sure there either. So, I mean, if you had to predict it right now, I mean, you have to imagine Gordon will be back. He's played well enough that, you know, it probably makes sense to match just about any offer. I mean, maybe you could say if there's a team that really loves him and wants to pay him the max, that you could try to extract a sign and trade instead. Payton feels like he probably won't be back. But who knows if he even gets an offer in restricted free agency or not. But I think they'll try to trade Payton. It's just, again, you know, what's really out there for him. I mean, but my question to you is, you know, what would you demand for Elfrid Payton? Would you be okay with a decent second rounder for him?
It would need to be an awfully good second rounder. What I'd be looking at, if that's what it is a young player that has at least rotation potential and is on team control, because those players actually have real value for the Magic. So something of that ilk, if you're going there, late first would be a whole hell of a lot better, just because you get that team control for an extra year, and that could be really valuable for them. But yeah, I mean, with Payton, if they don't think he's the answer for them at point guard, if they're, you know, they've had this front office changeover, they're not the front office that drafted
him. And I would assume that they don't, given that he was not the pick of this front office.
Right. So if that's the case, they should probably trade him, because another team would have more value with his restricted free agency. I think he could end up being a big loser this year, just because there are teams with money, but most of those teams don't need a point guard and don't need a point guard like him. So he could just be either taking a lower multi-year contract or even potentially the qualifying offer just because if he believes in himself and thinks that in 2019 he can do it. So yeah, there are teams that could just want that as an asset proposition. And, you know, even like, let's say we don't love his fit next to Devin Booker in Phoenix. I don't think either of us does. But if that's all it costs Phoenix is like a second round pick and maybe like one of their young dudes, like, I don't know how they're feeling about Ulis or somebody like that right now. That's a pretty good gamble for them because they have so many other assets that, you know, with the Heat picks and everything else, that sure, why not?
Yeah, Payton has provided some production at times, oftentimes late in seasons, has still a lot of defensive potential, although I think in the aggregate, he's disappointed for me on that. I mean, when he first came in as a rookie, I mean, I was like, wow, this guy is just all over the floor, just like showing up in places you don't expect with quick hands, but, you know, hasn't really been as good of an individual pressure defender as I would have liked to have seen ultimately. And very tough to fit around him, even if in a vacuum, he does provide some skills just due to the lack of shooting that he still has. But maybe there are teams who think, hey, you know, he's made some strides, we can continue to develop him. But you just have to say the Magic probably are not going to feel that way about him. But on the other hand, who's going to play point guard for this team next year if it's not Elfrid Payton? Maybe nobody, who knows? But it's difficult. I mean, it's just going to take a team that's like, hey, this guy's pretty young still, 24. It's not really that young. He's got some potential, has played well at times. We'll just try to get him as a restricted free agent, try to get him on a decent contract and just hope that he develops, and maybe he doesn't, but it's just kind of a flyer. And I'm not sure necessarily that team is out there.
I'm not either. And there are,
especially if the price is more than just like a second rounder. That's why I chose that amount as like a reasonable return. I mean, I think if I were the Magic, I probably would do that for a decent second. I know KP is rolling over in his grave here on this one, but I just think the fit with him is just so, so difficult. And he's not that good to just like have the ball in his hands all the time either, even if he is a bad shooter. So it's like, you know, you're putting the ball in his hands because you have to, because he can't play off the ball, but he's just not quite dynamic enough.
And the one good part about his restricted free agency, and if that's the price, is something more in that range, is that the opportunity cost is so low that it's not preventing you from doing something else. So like, let's say it's the Suns, I'm using them as the example, and a point guard that you like is available in the draft or free agency, you're not going to say, oh, we're not going to sign that guy because we have Elfrid Payton. You're going to do what you're going to do, and then if you can get him, great. If you had to give up a mid-first, like maybe would have been the option, you know, a year or so ago when people overvalued him a little bit, that could be there. Another kind of idea like that would be just from the asset proposition, somebody like Indiana or Charlotte, if they moved on from Kemba, just basically saying it's another option in case, because those teams don't really want to tank all the way. They could consider it, but I don't think it's a great move for either of them.
Ooh, if Carter Williams and Heaton on the same team, that would be pretty remarkable. Any chance you think they would move Aaron Gordon? I would listen on him.
I would absolutely listen on him. I mean, especially when you look at the way their books are. I mean, him he's more of kind of like the Otto Porter Max guy, just because maxes are artificially low. I don't think he can be the best, or is right now, the best or the second best player on a good team. And that's pretty much where I like to calibrate a max contract in normal circumstances, but it's a little bit too low right now. So with the way the system's structured,
he could maybe get there, but you just wonder how real the three-point shooting is for him. Because other than that, he's just basically kind of been pretty similar, I think, to the guy that he's always been. Another guy who, you know, on the right team and the right system could have a lot of defensive potential, but just on this non-competitive team for so many years, it's really, you know, that has not been unlocked for him.
And you need so much other talent around him. Like, you want a point guard who can feed him the ball. You want a rim protecting center still, because we know now he's not a centerpiece of a defense that's been they've been so disappointing, though that's mostly not his fault. It's just, you know, he's not providing as much value as we hoped there with his athleticism. And the idea of him being an ace wing defender is waning. It's not all the way dead, but it's pretty damn close.
Yeah. Well, he's only 22 still. So,
right.
And how much of like just having to play with Vucevic all the time, you know, just for fun, I'm going to look up what the defensive rating is with he and Biombo together. Yeah, that's 119.6.
Whee! So let's.
That's bad.
Just as a thought exercise, what kind of teams do you think it would make sense? I'm not going to say what's the price for him, but like, what sort of teams would you say, hey, that's worth a call? Like, I've thought about Indiana just because they have Thaddeus Young for one more year if he opts in. He would help them. I think that kind of thing could make sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think just, you know, a veteran team looking for some more athleticism and
Utah?
That would be, yeah, and that also could afford it, his contract. Yeah, he would be very interesting there. That'd be very interesting. You know, I'm not sure what asset they're giving back, though, that Orlando is going to want. And this is one of those ones where it's like, eh, maybe.
Well, that's why I'm talking more in the abstract, because I think in the abstract, just like where would Aaron Gordon be good is a worthwhile question in and of itself. If the Knicks had a very different distribution of talent outside of Kristaps Porzingis, a Gordon Porzingis front court would be awesome.
Concur. Yeah. There are a lot of teams that I think could use what he brings, especially if 3-point shooting, you know, it's not going to be 40% every year the way it's been most of this year, but, you know, if he could be 36% and then provide some athleticism, some more defense, get into a good system, you know, I think he could be very useful. I mean, I think, you know, on a Washington, he could be awesome, but Washington, you know, don't see how they have the assets to get him either. But a lot of teams that could really, I think, use that type of bounciness. He's at least an easy player to fit around, which, you know, in marked contrast to Peyton. But again, what the price is, you know, I mean, what would arouse your interest if you were Orlando?
A top 20 first and a young player of some renown, like a player that you think can actually be a part of your team in the next couple of years. I think if you don't feel comfortable giving him that contract, which I'm, as Orlando, probably not super comfortable about, that's about where I would be thinking.
All right, we got time to do Miami here real quick. Who most likely to be traded on the Magic?
I'm going to go with Shelvin Mack, just because if they want to be a little bit more proactive there. And while I think an Elfrid Payton trade makes some sense, I'm going to go with Shelvin Mack just because there are so many easy permutations where he's involved.
Yeah, as an expiring contract, a way to help other teams get off of money, which I think is the type of deal that this Orlando team should be looking at. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of potential options here. There's Hezonja, someone like a Mo Spates, maybe. We mentioned Payton as well. John Simmons maybe is someone that they might want to try and move. Again, in sort of this same idea of a guy, you know, Simmons is probably about properly paid. You know, he started off really hot this year and has fallen off, of course. But, you know, something like he and Mac to take back even, you know, a really worse contract than those two guys and maybe pick up a significant asset as well. You know, there's, I think, all of those quite possible. But yeah, I mean, if I had to pick it, probably Mac. So let's do Miami now. What position are they starting from here?
An unusual one, because they're $17 million under the tax, but they have a $5.5 million disabled player exception for waiters, so that can only be used for a player whose contract expires this season. They could also use their room exception for a buyout guy, something of that sort. So Miami has done that before. They've, you know, they got Joe Johnson, rehabilitated him, and he got all that money with the Jazz. They have no open roster spots right now, and they are right around the tax next year if they let Wayne Ellington walk, but I'm sure they want to bring Wayne Ellington back because he's been very useful for them this year.
Yeah, at age 30, Ellington has really come into his own as a shooter. That's what he'll be this offseason. And for next year, taking on money, not sure how much they're going to want to do that. I mean, they have an artificially good record with these performances in close games, but have been playing well enough that you think, hey, they might want to try and acquire someone. But they go up into the tax next year because they have two contracts that really balloon up. One is Tyler Johnson. You remember they matched his Arenas provision deal. So he goes from $5.9 million this year to $19.2 million next year. And then he has a player option, which I think he might exercise the next year for also that 19.2. And then Josh Richardson, who is actually, the way he's played recently, is looking like he'll probably be a steal. He got, as we called it, the Josh Richardson, the four-year 42 maximum value extension that they could have offered him. So he goes from 1.5 this year at the minimum to 9.4 next year. So that's why they're so much higher in salary next year committed than this year.
Also, their only high value expiring contract in terms of salary is Wayne Ellington, who they don't want to move. So there isn't really another way in that form. And one of the challenges for the Magic, unless Pat Riley sees this differently.
The Heat, you mean?
Sorry, yeah, the Heat.
I know the Magic are so fascinating. We can't get
South Florida. I'm in that mindset right now. Is that a lot of their other kind of ancillary pieces of the deeper guys on their roster are players that they really like. Rodney Magruder, Okoro White. And so it's a lot harder to make deals involving those guys if you really like them, as opposed to them being more filler flotsam type stuff. AJ Hammonds is the one big piece they have there, but I don't know what he does because he's under contract for another year at about $1.5 million.
Yeah, and that's one that you think if they're in the tax, they would probably want to try and move. I mean, I think probably with the emergence of Bam Adebayo and also having Kelly Olynyk, who's really a great modern backup center, that Whiteside, who has not really been himself with the injuries, but also is older than you think. You know, he's in his late 20s already, given how long it took him to kind of burst on onto the scene. I'm sure they would love to try to move him. Good luck.
Yeah, I mean, Whiteside's 28. He turns, so this is his age 28 season. Next year is age 29. He'll be making $27 million in his age 30 season under contract player option.
Yeah. I think he actually, might opt into that player option. I think, they haven't really been markedly better with him out there this season. See if he can get right and help them more. I mean, he's definitely has played well in the past, but certainly is overpaid, and we've talked so many times about how impacted the center market is. So I'm not really sure what the construct of a deal for him would be necessarily. It was floated around that maybe he could be a vehicle to get like a real star onto the team. But then also, of course, they're so limited in terms of the draft picks that they already owe.
They still have those two first rounders to Phoenix, top seven protected in 2018, then unprotected in 2019. On top of that, their 2021 pick unprotected, which means they cannot trade a first round pick before 2023. That's not great. And they've traded away all their seconds through 2023, except for 2022, which they still have.
Yeah, you could say that maybe there are some young guys who have some modicum of value, like White and Magruder, if he can come back. They probably would listen on Justice Winslow at this point, although his value is really at an nadir again after he's missed a bunch of time with a knee injury and missed last year with the shoulder and all that. So I'm sure they would love to maybe move Tyler Johnson as well, but nobody wants that balloon payment for next year. So I would suspect that they do very little. Maybe they would try to but they have so much room below the tax that it's almost just easier to release someone maybe they would just try to dump Hammonds on someone and maybe someone like White or Magruder and take back salary that just expires this year just to get Hammonds off the books for next year because he's still owed $1.5 million guaranteed. But I don't see, this is one of the least likely teams, I think, for me as far as making any kind of a move. And they'll probably just want to try to get into the buyout market, and they do have their room exception still, if I'm not mistaken.
They do, and the disabled player exception. So if they could clear some roster spots, that would actually really have some value for them because Miami will be desirable. With Waiters out, they have even more minutes in the rotation, though they have a lot of good players, as they always do.
All right, so most likely to be traded for them?
Ugh, Hammonds?
Yeah, I guess so. That seems most likely to me. And maybe you would have said it was Ellington if they were kind of out of it, and he's an expiring contract, and it's going to be hard for them to bring him back, but he's just so desperately needed for a team that's good right now. So Zach Lowe speculated that maybe he could get moved when he did his column in the Heat a couple weeks ago, and they've continued winning since then, and they've lost Deion Waiters, so they desperately need Ellington. He's playing 30 minutes a night, and he's providing a skill that nobody else on this team has, which is the shooting from deep. So yeah, I'll go with Hammonds too. I will get to the rest of our preview, then we got some news to do as well. But first, this from Simple Contacts. You can renew your prescription and reorder your brand of lenses from anywhere in minutes through an online self-guided vision test. And I had my fiance test it out. She's had contacts for years. And at first she's like, well, this is really annoying. Like, why do I have to go through this test? And I'm like, well, think about it this way. You just spend 2 minutes doing their vision test and you just saved yourself like the hours of having to go to the doctor and get your vision checked. And she's like, oh yeah, that's actually really, really efficient. All these tests are designed and reviewed by doctors. They're bringing the doctor's office to your home, and their contact lens prices are really good too. The vision test is $20. Shipping is free for the contact lenses. So should, of course, get a periodic full eye health exam, but if you're just trying to renew your prescription or get one, this is much, much better than what it normally would be. And for my listeners, you can get $30 off your first Simple Contacts order at simplecontacts.com/capspace, or you can use the capspace code at checkout. So it's simplecontacts.com/capspace. Easy to remember, capspace. Now we're back to talking about it all the time in the program. When I said we talked about it all the time in the program before, like these first couple of months, I was kind of fudging a little bit there, but we're back to talking about capspace all the time. So you can remember now, simplecontacts.com/capspace, or the capspace code will work for you as well. They'll get you $30 off your contacts and let them know that you came from us. So the Washington Wizards, Danny, where are they?
They're $5.7 million over the tax line. They have some of the mid-level yet left, but of course that can only be used on free agents. They do have one open roster spot, and the thing that makes it even more challenging for them is that they're about $5.7 million over, so about the same amount next season, even if they let most of their free agents go, assuming guys like Jason Smith pick up their options. So you know, if the team was better, I think that maybe Ted Leonsis would be more open to doing this. And I'm not sure that there's like a super obvious way. There is a way for them to get under the tax, but I can see them making kind of moves in that direction just because it's a lot of money to be saved by trying to get under the tax, even though it doesn't make their team better.
Yeah, and at least they do have all their draft picks going forward. But other than Kelly Oubre, they basically have given up a first rounder in three of the past 4 years now. They had that trade for Marcin Gortat. Then they had the trade for Markieff Morris. Then they actually drafted Oubre. And then they gave up their first to move off of Andrew Nicholson as well to get Bogdanovich. But of course, he is long gone. So you really, I mean, Smith has been out of the rotation since basically the very first game of the season, although he contributed last year. That contract was the one that we thought was the greatest lunacy of all their 2016 signings, and as it turned out, Mahimi has not contributed nearly as much. Getting off of Mahimi is something they're going to look to do as well, but let's just talk about Smith. What do you think the price would be to move on from him with his $5.5 million next season?
Moving on from Smith alone, so in terms of straight money for another team, it's about $10.5 million, so that to me is less than a first-round pick, but it saves the Wizards a lot of money because that gets them really close to the tax line. They could also expand it a little bit by including Chris McCullough or Sheldon Mack, who is out for the year, and then they could get all the way under, and that has real, real value for them. And if they moved both of those guys in a deal, so like let's say they did a 3-for-1, actually, if you want to hear it, I thought of a structure that could actually work for this. But the benefit there is that they could actually use some of that mid-level exception or just have minimum contracts to sign guys, and they would have roster spots. I think that would be a better use of it, because think about all this, the spots that they're basically wasting at this point. So there would be value in that. Maybe at that point you get into either giving up a straight first or giving up a first and getting a smaller asset in return.
Yeah, or it could be a similar construction as it was to last year, where they could hopefully get someone who could play. I mean, I'm trying to think of who is out there that would match salary for Jason Smith, who could give them something that would help them. I mean, I guess first we should talk about is just what do they need right now.
Their bench hasn't been as terrible as it was last year, but I think another perimeter player on the bench would be useful, especially if they could be a three, just another option there. I'm a staunch advocate that they should move Kelly Oubre into the starting lineup because Markieff Morris isn't really helping as much there, and so that would also create an even stronger need for that guy. However, those players are really hard to find, so do that. I think Satoransky and Meeks as a combo have been fine, and they still have Tim Frazier kind of backing up that in case somebody gets hurt or something like that. So I think they're okay there. Mahimi certainly not great, but I think in terms of backup centers, he's not too bad. And then depending on how they use Keith, they can do some different things there. So do you agree with me? Bench three is probably the biggest thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, if they really want to compete in the playoffs, getting someone who can defend at a higher level on the wing and be a little bit stronger, I think part of it. I mean, as we have noted before, their defense is pretty good, but we don't expect that to continue. They've had a little bit of luck in terms of opponents' three-pointers. And I think, were they the one who just had, like, opponents were hitting, like, some terrible... it was some other team that was hitting, like, a great percentage against them. We were saying their defense improved, so that wasn't them. Never mind. But yeah, I mean, they still really have had some struggles. You know, Meeks has been okay, but still is a negative 4.1 net rating. And, you know, like it so often is with these teams, John Wall, 4.7 net rating, Beal, 4.1. And then it's been the bench that has dragged them down. Although part of why their ratings are a little bit better is because Brooks has gotten more to all bench units instead of keeping one of those guys on the floor at all times. But certainly I would say somewhat of a disappointment, at least for them, not to me. This is kind of about where I expected them to be this year. I mean, just in terms of players who might be out there and as trade candidates, Mark Stein noted that the Wizards had been rumored maybe as a place for Tyreke Evans, and Mark said no, like that was shut down for him. You know, I'm not sure they necessarily, you know, they could use maybe one more bench playmaker, but Evans is a guy who probably doesn't really fit in their best lineups. I mean, I think if you're going to give up the first rounder again as part of getting off the money, you really want to get someone who could realistically be in your closing lineup perhaps. And you know, maybe another option would be, what about like Mahinmi and a first for Wes Matthews? It's probably not enough, I'm going to say.
It's too much bad money for the Mavericks for that price. I mean, because they have actual aspirations, you know, that they can do something with that. And Wes Matthews plays a more valuable position, and they already have paid a lot of money to centers. I mean, and Salah Mejri is still, you know, these are going to be restricted free agents. So yeah, I think that's not enough for me. I, for a fleet fleeting second thought about, wonder about Derek Favors there. But I don't think there's really a way to make that work just because it gets into the same issues they've had with the Jazz. So that's not necessarily helpful.
Yeah.
And
I've got one for you. What about James Ennis?
I like it. I love James Ennis. So yeah, totally on board.
And they would have early bird rights on him if they wanted to re-sign him. He'll be 28 this offseason. You know, Memphis, I mean, I'm sure if they could get a first rounder. Part of the problem with the Wizards trading first rounders is, like, you know, their first rounder is pretty decent every year. It's like, you know, 17 or 18 or something most of these years.
Wait, something else I want to mention, just because sometimes we write this off and other times we talk about it. If Ted Leonsis was willing to pay the luxury tax, Bojan Bogdanović, with the price that he ended up getting, would have been really helpful for this team. Like, he wouldn't have solved all of their problems, but I mean, think about the contract he got with the Pacers. If he had gotten that exact same contract for them, I think he would be a value for them.
Yeah, well, I mean, he is likely going to have to pay the tax with where they are now, $5.7 million over, as you noted. And just clearing off some money just to get into the buyout market as well. They still have $1.9 million left of their mid-level exception that they could use. Joe Johnson, I think, might be someone else that they could think about potentially. You know, if they could put together McCullough and Jason Smith for him. But again, you know, that's, now we're talking about, you're not actually reducing your tax bill, right? We're talking about, and in Johnson's case, you'd be increasing it most likely. Maybe there's a way. I mean, I don't think they have enough kind of other bad salary that they could put together. I mean, maybe you could say Satoransky. I mean, they would need still some kind of backup point guard, though. Satoransky's been playing for him. So maybe like Meeks, Jason Smith, and Chris McCullough. I mean, that still really only gets you Sheldon Mack as well, who I think they're almost certainly going to try and dump. The reason they haven't yet is just because he would have been on their books all year because he tore his Achilles, and you're on the books until you're healed, unless you have an Exhibit 9, which Mack, of course, didn't on a longer than 1 year deal. So if you put all those guys together, then maybe you get Joe Johnson, but you're still probably not saving enough, right? So you probably would need to, and there's nobody else really who has a small enough salary that would work for. They would just aggregate together. And Mahimi, of course, is such bad money that, you know, in a deal like that, it's Utah is not going to hamstring themselves that much with where they're at as a franchise.
So I'll give you my proposal, which I am also putting out there for the people who are doing the mock trade deadline. If they want to use it, they can. So the idea is basically that Phoenix can actually do this. What they do is they trade either Mack or McCullough, doesn't really matter, into Phoenix's space. Then Phoenix cuts them. Then they trade the other one. Then they cut them. And then they trade Jason Smith. Either you could do Jason Smith, or if they want to send back some small guy, because they had to have to clear one contract because they have 15 guaranteed. And so, and then you include like a first round pick or something there. And so the reason that you do that trade is a 3-for-1 would force Phoenix to cut way too many guys, but they actually have enough cap space to do those as separate transactions. And so do it that way, cut the guy. And then Washington gets under the cap, under the tax enough, they get all the way under, they could still use their mid-level exception. So that provides even more value to them. And then they could, you know, and they would have three roster spots then to use. So they could go like split that mid-level or do whatever they wanted. And then I think they would still have some minimums. I haven't done the full number with prorated stuff, but I think it'd be valuable for them.
They have all their cash, right?
I believe they do.
So you would imagine that at the very least, what they would do would be pay a team to take McCullough and Mack. And the reason they probably haven't done that yet is because that's just even more palatable to do that, you know, when they've paid their salary for 60% of the year, as it'll have been when the trade deadline comes along. And so if they have $5 million in cash that they can send with those guys, they can not only pay those guys salary, but then throw in a cash sweetener. And that would be something that would make sense for all sides. That might be something that just, you know, when the dust kind of clears and all the major moves have been made, they can find someone to do a deal like that. So I would expect that at a minimum, you would see that happen. It's just a question now of whether they can move on from Jason Smith as well. And cash is not going to be enough to get that done. I mean, they might get, but that would at least reduce their tax bill. Even if they move on from those guys, they would obviously have to get some new guys for the roster, but, you know, they could get into the buyout market then as a result. So those, if I had to pick the kind of deal that they're most likely to do, I'd say they're probably not going to do anything other than, you know, Chris McCullough and Sheldon Mack for cash, with some cash for, you know, a funny money second rounder.
See, I'll say my most likely player to be traded is Sheldon Mack, just because, especially because he can't contribute. I don't know. You could make an argument that McCullough's better, but I don't think either one.
Yeah.
I don't think
I would say McCullough would be the more likely one to get traded, because they might even want to just hold on to Mack and his restricted rights. I mean, I thought they liked him at times.
True.
I mean, you know, he did coming off the torn Achilles, but he's young enough, hopefully, to bounce back from that. And as a restricted free agent, agent. Maybe they could just bring him back. Although, do they want to even make him a qualifying offer, which he would instantly accept? Probably, you know, maybe not. But maybe they'd want to hold on to him. I think if I had to pick one guy, and also McCullough makes more as well at $1.5 million, and he had his fourth year option declined, and you know, basically hasn't played at all. So yeah, I would say McCullough probably most likely to be traded there. Max second.
Oh, one just to have this out there. One other thing. So the Wizards do have all their own first, but their 2019, 20, and 21 seconds are gone. So they could trade this year's, but then after that, they're a little bit more limited.
Yeah, and second rounders begin to come to a premium when you're a team that's in the tax and you're trying to dump money, as they are going to be for quite some time here, it would seem. Let's do a little bit of news here, and we're starting with some really depressing stuff out of San Antonio.
Yeah, if we hadn't recorded the trade deadline preview part first, we would have started, I would presume, with the Kawhi Leonard news. Kawhi, the word that is that he'll sit indefinitely with tendinopathy, and indefinitely can mean a lot of different things. It's doing some serious lifting here. The Spurs have said that they expect him to play this year, which kind of freaked me out more, even though you could phrase that as a positive thing. But he just hasn't really bounced back from this in the way that they had hoped. And it is really all about, you know, getting him back to 100% at some point. And so if shutting him down, as Pop said today, if that gets people to ask fewer questions, I'm not sure it will. But if it helps him recover, then so be it.
Yeah, and he's just going to go back into rehab. And it seemed like he had not played on less than 2 days rest yet. And so the issue was really, as it is with a lot of these tendonitis, soreness kind of issues, it seems like most often with a tendon issue, we've seen this with Mike Conley as well, that it really takes a long time for it to heal. Reggie Jackson was another one too. He was never really quite right last year either with that severe tendonitis. And so he tried to warm up apparently on Monday, which would have been his first attempt at playing on less than 2 days rest after he had a really nice game on Saturday in a blowout of the Nuggets. And he then just felt like, hey, it doesn't quite feel right. And then the decision is made that, hey, we're going to shut him down and he's just going to have to do more rehab. So definitely discouraging. He had not looked quite like himself, seemed to be making a few strides. But again, you know, the issue is just, all right, you can play one game, but then what do you feel like the next day? And that's what Pop's comments seem to be focused on.
To compound that, Rudy Gay is out at least another 2 weeks with his heel injury. So San Antonio out two players who largely play the same position. Fortunately, they have gotten Danny Green back, though he's not 100%. He's playing through some of his groin issues, and Pau Gasol is as well. So it isn't...
Yeah, Gasol with a hand issue,
correct.
I believe, actually.
Yeah, I lumped them together with different injuries. And so what this means at this point is San Antonio and Minnesota are... They're one game apart now because San Antonio won their last game. They won at Brooklyn, and Minnesota lost at Orlando, which was a rough loss for them. They just got outplayed. I mean, I think that was a big part of it. And also, Evan Fournier hit a bunch of shots, and Biombo had the best game of one of the better games of his life. But San Antonio, I think right now, it's more likely that they'll fall to the four than that they'll get the three, just because we don't know how long Kawhi is out, and Minnesota has played so much better recently. But that creates this kind of crazy circumstance for me, where if let's say you could take it as an assumption that the Spurs and Thunder were playing in the 4-5, wouldn't you rather be the two seed than the one in the West?
Maybe. But, and you might also, though, want to be the sixth seed than the five. You might rather face the Wolves in the first round than face the Spurs, who, you know, assuming that Leonard does in fact return. As of now, Spurs 30-16, Wolves 29-17, so Wolves one game behind. But ESPN's BPI noting that the Spurs have the hardest schedule remaining in the league, which that's particularly remarkable when you're a good team because you don't have to play yourself. Usually bad teams will have harder remaining schedules. And so the Spurs, we've seen them get very lucky in crunch time. We talked about it in the 15-60, like their clutch net rating is like plus 33 this year or something. And some of that is probably their execution, but a lot of it is just luck. And then you also consider the tough schedule going forward. I do expect the Wolves to outplay them. They have a 4.5 game lead on the Thunder still. The Thunder had some foibles, but it had a nice win at home against the Lakers. And I think generally they're going to start playing better, but Thunder actually have a better projected point differential than the Spurs do. So not entirely. And I know the Thunder would love to get out of the Warriors bracket to be sure. So our dream match, I mean, I thought it was looking pretty set that it was going to be Rockets and Spurs in the 2-3, a rematch from last year, which would have been awesome. And then hopefully Thunder Warriors or Wolves Warriors, either of those would have been really cool in the 1-4. But now might be a little bit messed up here with Kawhi. And I mean, you know, we have no idea how much longer he's going to be out for it. But, you know, my guess would be another month, probably. You know, I mean, that's kind of like what this feels like. I mean, certainly there'd be no reason to bring him back before the All-Star break.
A month has been the basic timeline that I've been using, 4 to 6 weeks, kind of. And remember that when he's coming back, I assume
Not that we heard that.
No. It's just knowing what the Spurs do. And also, remember that with Kawhi coming back from this again, he's not going to come back and play 30 minutes a night. You know, they're going to be slow about this, be deliberate about it again.
Yeah,
I would
just as it was before.
Right.
So this will really probably be the first year that they really are just like, all right, we don't care about the regular season that much. I mean, they got to get Kawhi healthy. That's the only thing that matters for this team. And hopefully, you would hope that they could have had a chance to get some time playing with LaMarcus at center, and Gay and Kawhi have not played together hardly at all. And his injury is troubling too. I mean, he was supposed to be out for 2 weeks before a reevaluation, and he's supposed to be out, you know, a fair amount of time still with his own issues with this right heel injury. So I can't remember if it's right or left. I think it's right heel and towards left heel, but that. But in any event, just a shame that we're not going to get to see San Antonio at full strength for a long time here. It's been one of the, I just haven't enjoyed watching them as much this year without Kawhi. And I kept, you know, I was sort of like, I'll watch more Spurs later when they're whole, and they're just, you know, they're never whole. So in other news, Avery Bradley, after a loss in Detroit, apparently continuing to be bothered by groin injury. I thought he had already seen a specialist, and we had some concern about that, but he'd continued to play. But Rod Beard saying that Bradley is going to see a specialist in Philadelphia about his groin tomorrow. And, you know, that's never good when the guy goes to the specialist and it's been nagging him for a while. You know, you could see it potentially getting shut down. What else do we have here?
Two disabled player exception pieces of news. I believe the deadline for applications was the 15th, so it's not a surprise that we're getting this right around now. Brooklyn got a $6 million one for Jeremy Lin. And the Pelicans got a $2.75 million one for Alexei Ginta. And appropriate that this is in one where we already talked about this with Dion Waiters, because what this is, you can get a player, you can either sign somebody to that money or you can get somebody who is on an expiring contract. And it's less likely that New Orleans is going to use it because they're butting right up against the luxury tax. But maybe.
Yeah, and the hard cap. And the hard cap. With those weird holiday incentives.
And Brooklyn, you know, maybe they could. They could do some interesting stuff. As it turns out, that would have been a very useful thing to use to get Jahlil Okafor had it existed at that point, because then they could have kept Trevor Booker, done something else with him. But Philly wanted Trevor Booker and they paid a heavy price, so that worked out.
Yeah, well, it made sense, actually. I mean, they could have applied for this earlier with Lin, but the problem was they actually had cap room, and so they didn't want to have the exception on the books, which would have taken them over the cap, and then to complete a trade, they would have had to renounce the exception. So it made more sense to just hold on to the cap room, and now on the last possible day to apply for it. I'm guessing, you know, I mean, a torn patellar tendon, clearly you're going to be out for the year. So I'm guessing that's why they waited until just now.
I think so too. That's smart. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of those things where I was like, yeah, what the hell? This Lin injury happened a long time ago. Why didn't they wait? Why did they wait so long? That's probably what the reason is. The fallout from, I don't know, blank gate, whatever you want to call it here, with the Rockets and Clippers has come down. Trevor Ariza and Gerald Green, after extensive interviewing review of security footage. There's not a security camera in the so-called secret passage, but there is in the main one. So that exonerated Clint Capella, who didn't actually, as it turned out, knock on the Clippers door. I think there's talk that Tarik Black did knock on the door, and I think that like someone on the Clippers just like thought that Capella, like Black was Capella or something, but neither of them got suspended. Ariza and Gerald Green were suspended 2 games each. They apparently were the aggressors. Testimony from everyone, including Clippers, was that James Harden and Chris Paul were there, but we're kind of trying to be more peacemakers. And then the Rockets really wanted some discipline against Blake Griffin for bumping into Mike D'Antoni, and wanted Austin Rivers to face punishment too, per Tim McMahon, but that did not in fact occur.
It didn't, and I expressed some criticism, not necessarily, though I didn't like that Griffin didn't, I mean, he got a tech, but they didn't get further punished for it, because he intentionally ran into D'Antoni. Like, that's a kind of a different thing than just it happened.
Well, I thought he was trying to do the Kid Woodson thing.
Mm-hmm. And so
I don't know.
Yeah. So and they wanted Rivers, I think, because he was standing on the floor. Though standing on the floor during a game, that kind of crap, It shouldn't happen. I believe that there should be stronger punishments for that, but this isn't really necessarily the time to implement it. And I understand why the Rockets are a little bit mad about it, but, you know, them's the breaks.
Apparently you can't just suspend someone for being an asshole. So that's a precedent.
That seems like as good a transition as we're going to have to getting into the Pelicans Hawks game.
We do have one more, though, which is Jordan Bell went down today with what appears to be a high ankle sprain. Looks like an eversion ankle sprain, which is also what Derrick Rose suffered earlier. Those ones can be trickier than your normal inversion ankle sprain where you land on someone's foot. Robin Lopez dunked on him and then kind of caught him with his off arm, as Lopez is wont to do. And Bell came down awkwardly on his left leg, and it looked like, sort of like his shin moved inside of where his foot was and caused it to turn outward. And so high ankle sprain, eversion ankle sprain, those can be tricky. And you have to imagine that we won't see him until after the All-Star break, at least. He certainly was appeared to be in a lot of pain, and people were really concerned, but thankfully not a severe knee injury, at least.
Yeah, I mean, the in certain injuries, what freaks people out is how the player reacts, and Jordan Bell looked very, very concerned, and he, getting people over, tried to walk on it, couldn't really do that, and ended up taking him out on a wheelchair. And then we don't know exactly the severity. Did you see the Chris Dunn injury?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he was able to walk off under his own power. The issue as far as playing will be, that's why I never liked hanging on the rim when I dunked off of 1 foot back when I could actually dunk, because that's what can happen to you. I never felt like I had the coordination to actually grab on and not just fall off like that. But he appeared to bust up his mouth pretty badly. Not sure whether there might have been a concussion involved there or not. We'll see.
We'll have to see with that. And his absence ended up swinging that game a little bit, because the Bulls were coming back and they put in Denzel Valentine to replace him, and the Warriors were able to skate by and win that game by, I think, it was 5.
Also, real quickly on the Bulls, Casey Johnson reporting today that Jaren Grant might be on the block. He shot it poorly from 3-point range for the Bulls, and they maybe want to get a look at the white whale Cameron Payne, who is all they have left to show from that big trade with OKC last trade deadline, once he's actually healthy, and obviously Zach LaVine using up a lot of those minutes as well. Let's talk about this Atlanta-New Orleans game. What do you got?
So, I mean, it's ties in with a couple of different stories, concerns about the Pelicans. They had that wonderful win against Boston, which I feel a little bad that we didn't do, because that was in certain ways, a more important thing than this, but there are two. So one is, yes, it was on a back-to-back, you're on the road, but the Hawks aren't great. And not only that, but Anthony Davis only took 8 shots in this game.
Yeah, after 45-point nights in overtime, 2 games in a row. And the point was made to me that he is tired, but this is something that David Lockett has been talking about a lot, which is Davis has the highest variance just in terms of his play from game to game of any player in the NBA. And we can speculate as to why that is. Maybe it's because he has these nagging injuries that, he feels real good or bad on certain days. Maybe it's he plays so many minutes. Maybe some days he plays more defense. And what my most favorite explanation for that, which is just he's much more dependent as a player for getting his shots. He's not, despite his brilliance, not a guy you necessarily throw it to and say, all right, just go get us a bucket. Although, we saw a little bit more of that against the Knicks. That's because he had the matchup with the speed advantage on Kristaps Porzingis. And actually, in most of his matchups at power forward, he does not really have the speed advantage. So, you can't just throw it to him and say, hey, face up, go off the dribble, attack this guy. So I think all those are potential reasons for the variance that he has. But, it explains how, in addition to the fact that it was a back-to-back or whatever, that the Pels can go on the road and beat Boston one night and then, get beaten by the Hawks. And they looked real bad offensively in the second half.
Well, I mean, you had that third quarter where Atlanta not only outscored them by 16, but had a 21-3 run, meaning the three of the Pelicans scored were over, was that 6-7 minutes, something like that?
Oh, yeah. At the end of the third, I mean, they scored only the 10 points in the third. And then at the beginning as well, the Hawks actually surged back to a lead. And then New Orleans was able to look like they pretty close to having it in control, leading 90-85 with 2:19 remaining, but then just were not really able to get great shots down the stretch. And Kent Bazemore had a fantastic game. What really killed them was we've talked about the Hawk set that the Thunder run. And one of the things that Ben Falk has pointed out, who introduced that set to us, is the Thunder don't really look for the actual Hawk cut, which is similar to a UCLA cut where, they set the back screen for the guy on the strong side at the free throw line. Well, Well, the Hawks got two layups in a row by Kent Bazemore, and I thought it was an interesting decision. I mean, Ian Clark has been closing games for them. For some reason, Etuan Moore was on the bench instead, which is ridiculous. Like, Etuan Moore is just a much better player than Ian Clark is, especially on defense. And I believe Clark was guarding Bazemore for part of the time. And then at the end, Bazemore made an unbelievable pull-up J over Anthony Davis. It was the second night in a row that AD had had a shot made on him in the last 10 minutes of the game, or last 10 seconds of the game off a switch. Bazemore hit this really tough fadeaway on him to give the Hawks the lead. And then, I don't know, anything else you want to say before we get to that final play about kind of the end there?
Well, so on when they had a 92-89 lead, what the Hawks did was they basically just had Ilyasova come back up, and John Collins was in a really sweet spot because he had his own guy. Well, it was kind of a jumbled possession for the Pelicans. And DeMarcus Cousins stayed in the paint instead of following Ilyasova out. So all Collins had to do was stand in front of Jrue Holiday, and Ilyasova was wide open, just cans the three. So that made it a tie game. And it was, I think that was about a minute left. And then on the next play, they got a 1-4 pick and roll. And so then it was Holiday, and I thought Davis did a pretty nice job screening there on Schroeder. And Collins didn't get out, but Holiday airballed the shot, so they didn't get any sort of ill effect there. And that was really the last, kind of full possession, like, kind of thing that they got, because then DeMarcus Cousins got fouled on the drive by Collins.
Yeah, and Cousins missed one of two free throws, which obviously hurt them, and then Bazemore made his shot. Just overall, AD, the 2 of 8 for 8 points. Cousins, 6 out of 17, 19 points for him. And they got plenty from the rest of their guys. Holiday was fantastic, although it didn't do nearly as much damage in the second half. He was 8 for 11 with 19 points in the first half, and then he was 0 of 5. No, I'm sorry, he was 1 out of 5 in the second half for 3 points. Rondo got the Keith Bogans, which I approve of, but just closing with Clark, who played 29 minutes in this one instead of Moore, really just did not make much sense to me. Moore had 12 points in 22 minutes. He was great, I thought. So, and just a much better defensive player, and, you know, not quite as good of a shooter as Clark is, but still, you know, about as good, and has a higher release. Darius Miller had a big game too for 17 points. So this is, I mean, they should have won this game. The big problem, I think, was just that their stars didn't play better, or maybe they ran out of gas.
I wanted to ask you, because you watched more of this game than I did during the meat of it, how did John Collins look to you? Because his final line was phenomenal.
He had some moments. I mean, defensively, he's a little spacey, but showed at least some activity, you know, which is a little bit better. He got beat on a backdoor for an alley-oop for AD, one of his two field goals. But 7 of 8 from the field, 4 of 4 from the foul line, so 18 points on 10 shooting possessions. That's pretty damn good. Didn't get on the glass quite as much, but he did close the game. He was closing the game at center with Ilyasova next to him. Ilyasova had a nice game too, with 15 points on 9 shooting possessions. He had that big three late, as did Bazemore with the game winner, and also 20 points for him. This is for the Hawks side. This is a matchup. I was reminded, because I haven't watched them that closely in a little bit, that they have two of my least favorite players in the league to watch, which are Ilyasova and Bellinelli, just two inveterate floppers who, you know, Bellinelli just takes some awful shots. So that was, I don't really care for watching this team much. Schroeder's never been a favorite of mine. Miles Plumlee, not exactly my favorite. Deadman is back now. He played 20 minutes, but didn't do that much. No one on this team I really enjoy watching, other than Collins, I would say, at the point.
And it's too early for the Hawks. I'm sure some of the fans are like, oh God, we won again, because they're trying to get the best pick they can. But at this point, I think that's totally fine, and they're 13-31, so they got some ground.
Yeah, you know, that's basically right where the Heat were last year. But yes, I do not beat a surge of that ilk. Also worth noting, actually, that Malcolm Delaney is back in the rotation. Isaiah Taylor is out again, and yeah, I think that's... Oh, well, so then the final play, right? 2 seconds left. They advance the ball, try to inbound it just to, like, a straight post-up for Cousins. That gets deflected out of bounds, so now they've got 1.9 left. Cousins actually did a better job of stealing Ilyasova. They got it into him. Gentry, the second time, put in Rondo to make the entry pass, which was a smart move, because he's still, you know, a great passer, obviously. And I thought that Ilyasova very clearly followed Cousins on that play, because he's behind him, and so basically what he did was he put put both of his arms straight out, like around the torso of Cousins, and then never moved them. And so then Cousins tried to turn and go up for the shot. So his arms are not straight up, they're way out. His arm hits Cousins as he goes to turn into his, 9 foot kind of hook shot, hits him on the arm. Cousins misses. I mean, I don't see how on earth that's not a foul.
It didn't strike me that way on the first look, but then when I saw it again, like a lot of times when a guy misses a shot that looks kind of weird, you look at body contact and you go, oh, okay. And that's really the way it was for me.
And you just, like, you're not allowed to just put your arms straight outside the cone of your body. If you do that and contact occurs, it's a foul on you. And that's what happened on this play. It's Ersan Ilyasova, who takes a ton of charges and is kind of a darling of the refs, and DeMarcus Cousins, who certainly is not. I'm not sure. And it's also just at the end of the game. But I'll be very interested to see the 2-minute report on this one. I'm going to check that tomorrow because, I think they do go to some extent. They certainly try to err on the side of justifying the call whenever possible. And I'll be curious to see what the explanation is if, in fact, they do justify that.
Yeah, I'll be excited for that. I didn't watch.
excited for the 2-minute
but
report.
I didn't watch. I actually was, for part of the time, the crazy ending for Grizzlies Knicks where Courtney Lee got a technical on a jump ball, but we didn't watch it, so we can't talk about it. I just wanted to mention it because I'm sure some people would be like, hey, what are your thoughts? We didn't see it, so.
Yeah. At some point after the trade deadline, I think maybe we should just do a show where, like, we just watch as many games as possible and just whatever we want to over the course of a night, and then we'll just talk about whatever we saw. We don't have to necessarily do it of like, okay, we're going to watch these 4 games, be so locked in. We'll just, hey, we'll give you some observations. Kind of
odds and ends.
Kind of like what Kelly Dwyer used to do on those great columns he would write back in the day for Ball Don't Lie, where he would just like write a paragraph or two about every game that happened that night on a big night. I always used to like read those, so too bad that those are gone. But it's too bad that our show is gone. It is over now. Don't forget about Simple Contacts, simplecontacts.com/capspace is the URL. All right, talk to y'all probably Sunday. Till then.